Uncut, uncensored, and unfiltered. This is MLW Radio. Now, your hosts, Court Bauer and...
Orgullosamente Latino hasta la muerte y después. Worldwide Latino pride, the ambassadors of violence. K-Dog in this frame.
Órale, arriba la raza. This is MLW.com. We're back in the cut with my boy, Kurt Bauer. Representing the NYC, I'm over here in the 619, and we got our boy, a good friend of ours, a guy that we both looked up to and read many of his newsletters throughout the years, as many of you guys have too, the one and only, the only one, Dave Meltzer. Boom.
How you guys doing?
Pretty
AKA,
good.
AKA Dexter. Boom. Nothing.
Do you know what that reference? He believes that you look like Dexter.
Dexter, yeah. He told me that many times before.
Okay, did you – now, I asked you this probably maybe a year ago or less, and Kurt probably has a better recollection than I do. If you would watch any of the Dexter episodes, I believe you said you would, and I have a feeling you haven't.
You have a feeling, right? I can't even keep up with – I can't even keep up with wrestling these days.
Right.
It's so ridiculous.
It's crazy now. I mean, look at 2014, and you have WWE with a network, which just never-ending footage, the archival stuff, all that stuff. You have TNA, which technically is still with us, and you have Ring of Honor, which does a weekly show, and then you have Triple H coming up with El Rey, and then Jeff Jarrett's project. It's like there's a ton of wrestling in 2014, and I wonder, you know, if the supply will meet the demand, and if there's a demand for all of this.
Well, there's not, but it's the same thing. It's like in MMA, it's just a question of if you know, as more and more television stations come around, the standard of what you need, you know, to draw an above average rating gets lower and lower. So, and wrestling, you know, even if like a certain percentage of wrestling fans are willing to watch the show, essentially the you know, the if it's more than like would normally watch a station, and wrestling usually has enough of a cult audience that it usually beats station averages, then it's valuable programming. I think that we're seeing that with both pro wrestling and MMA. What we're seeing is there's a oversupply for as far as it comes to the popularity of the product, but you can make money on it from the TV standpoint that you never could before. Before, you know, these companies were relying on live gates and pay-per-views and merchandise and things like that. And now, you know, the big money is if you can sell your TV rights, and TV is willing to pay because they're willing to pay for anything that can give them a better rating than average and can up the profile of their station.
Right, and I think a good example of that is like somebody like TNA, which doesn't really have, you know, big ratings, especially compared to WWE or what we pulled back in the day with WCW, but it still has enough to keep them on the air. Like sometimes you'll see shows, and I'm sure both of you seen them, you know, shit like the Amish Mafia.
Right.
Like who the fuck watches that? But enough people are watching it to keep it on the air. You know what I'm saying? And
yeah, well, I mean, this the standard of what you need to be viable on television is lower and lower because
right.
There's so much dilution of you know, television because you get so many stations, and all these stations, you know, when you get, let's say, if you get 500 stations, you know, you got maybe your 10 or 20 stations that are pretty strong, and then you got 480 stations that are looking for just anything that will draw any kind of an audience. So, you know, wrestling
And you know what's funny, Dave, that just goes back to that word that we always hear so much, but you hear it so much that sometimes it loses its meaning, which is corporate greed. And by that, I mean this. If you look at football, how they expanded the more teams, or baseball, how they expanded the more teams, one of the things you always hear the hardcores or even the older players complain about is that you know, the game has been diluted because you have so many guys that are really athletic, but they don't have their fundamentals down. And you have so many more pitchers, you know, since you have so many pitchers and a lot of them aren't good, a lot of guys are getting hits, you know, a lot more hits than before. And so, you know, the same thing happens in sports, the same that's now happening in wrestling. You know, you have so many channels of programming that I think you're going to be able to hold maybe even three or four companies at the same time.
Well, I mean, the one thing that's interesting about that is that...
Would you agree with that or no?
It's well, the potential is there. The thing is that right now we're in a position where, you know, for years and years, the number of jobs in American wrestling, I mean, when I talk about like full-time regular jobs, has diminished greatly. I mean, when you were in WCW, just an example, there were more guys on WCW contract than there are people making a living in pro wrestling in the United States now, and that's not even including WWE, and there was still, you know, ECW was going on at the time as well, and there were other groups around that were, you know, floundering, but were still around. And now, you know, but the point is that with this expansion in television, we may have a situation similar to sports, because in NFL, baseball, basketball, because there's more teams, there's more jobs in those sports than before. And so the quality of the players, the old timers will say it's diluted the quality. Like if we look at wrestling, I mean, really, you know, you can argue about the quality of the wrestlers, but there's actually way fewer jobs in wrestling as compared to years ago. But maybe that will expand, you know, in the next couple of years with more companies getting in. So I think that's something to look at as well.
It's interesting because I'm looking at, like, where's the talent going to come from to populate all these companies by, say, the end of 2014 if they're going to all be full-time? It's not like there's that much talent. I mean, there's not a lot of polished guys. You're looking, I guess, at a lot of young guys or maybe some of the older guys from the Attitude Era. I don't even know.
But I don't think that going with the a few older guys as teachers,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like maybe
yeah,
it's
right.
Like, you know, like player-coach type guys I think would be valuable, but you don't really want to populate your roster with a lot of older guys, because we really saw that with TNA, and it really turned out to be a mistake when you went with guys from another era. You know, it just kind of held the young guys back, and the young guys never really, you know, I mean, they struggled to get their due.
Right.
And I think there's been a huge paradigm shift, because I think now, unlike before, when you get to a certain age, unless you're like a legend or a really big name or somebody in the office likes you, you're not going to last around as long as they did back in the day. You know what I'm saying? Because they've gone to definitely a younger roster and a youth movement.
That, but the other thing too is, you know, the it's like a shelf life, because you're ground out quicker in a sense,
right,
of if you were in another era, you wouldn't be in angles every single week. And then if you kind of got stale, there was like with WWF, let's just say you were in WWF for 5 years and you kind of were getting bored there and they were getting tired of you, you could switch to WCW and you could revitalize your career. And then maybe WWE would all of a sudden go like, hey, you know, like maybe we did, you know, maybe he belongs here, especially if you got a little bit of popularity in WCW. So you could go back and forth, and that would really lengthen your career when you're, you know, guys that are, you're in WWE and you're there week after week. And, you know, they have a tough time. You know, they have their chosen ones that they'll elevate, and then occasionally guys, the fans will elevate themselves. But most guys, you know how it is like they kind of have a mindset of, okay, this is where this guy's slotted, this is where this guy's slotted. And when you got that, when you got like Kofi Kingston and Dolph Ziggler and Damian Sandow, like I'm just throwing those names out, you end up where, you know, you've seen those guys wrestle each other 400 times each, Jack Swagger, you know, I mean, if you really look at it. So it's kind of like there when you're in that kind of holding pattern, it's like, yeah, you know, you're there, but you're, you know, you could, you know, you kind of don't get anywhere, so to speak.
Well, they also have so much TV now. I mean, you know, in the 80s or the 70s, even the 90s for the most part, you had like an hour, maybe 2 hours, and you crammed those hours with prelim matches, and so you kept the matches fresh. And now you have so much TV because of the rights thing, and there's so many matches, and they don't do prelim matches, so you're giving away pay-per-views every week, which was the Bischoff thing, which his counter-strategy to Raw was, I'm going to give away pay-per-view matches on Nitro, and we're still following that today just to keep ratings going and so on, because now the audience is conditioned. You can't – it's very difficult to pull back to, like, a imagine a three-hour show full of prelims or, like, just so-so matches, like, on primetime back in the day. That would be very hard to pull off.
Yeah, because the crowd is you know, the,
yeah.
The and
you
crowd
know
what, would have a tough time with it.
Yeah.
You know what's funny, Dave, and this is kind of more from our era. I don't know how much Kurt got to see this, but if you remember, obviously, like Kurt just said, this was pre-Monday Night Wars. But remember, almost every fucking TV match was just a star beating up some fucking jobber. And if you wanted to pay to see him, you had to go see him in the arena. You know what I'm saying?
Right, the arena or you know, to see star versus star. One of the good things about that, and there's good things and bad things. I mean, the problem with that today is that for whatever reason in the old days, predictability never hurt. I mean, wrestling was really, you know, was very, very predictable, but I think people were comfortable with it. They understood right. The pattern, and it's like they kind of wanted it to be that way. Now people want unpredictability. So that's changed it. But the good thing about that system is that guys weren't damaged because, you know, like a guy like just a Jack Swagger, for example, you wouldn't see him lose, you know, 52 weeks a year or 30 weeks a year. You would see him lose almost never because he would be one of the guys that, you know, he wouldn't be a top guy, but he wouldn't be a guy that would be getting beat on television. Yeah. Somebody would be losing to him. So those guys would have more cachet than they have now when they're just kind of seen as 50-50 guys, whereas then they would be guys who would probably win 95% of the time.
And it's so weird to me because Vince believes that his dad booked or presented talent in a 50-50 even Steven kind of way. And I mean, that's before my time, but I can't imagine that he did that a lot. I can't imagine
he
that's
didn't,
what
he didn't. Vince's father, the booking of WWF
right.
was probably the most predictable booking that there was, but it was also very effective for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, he had guys slotted in different situations. I mean, the baby faces, I mean, on TV, nobody lost, so it wasn't 50-50. I mean, like, the guys who lost were the guys who always lost. The guys who won were the guys who always won. And when it came to the arena booking, he may do 50-50 with Johnny Rods and you know, those type of guys in prelims where it didn't matter who won or lost. I mean, when it came to the top guys, yeah, you know, he would go back and forth in the sense that the babyface champion would lose on a DQ or might lose on a blood stoppage or a count out 1 week, and then he would come back and get his revenge, you know, then a month later. But the babyface, the top babyfaces rarely lost. I mean, you would have.
But
like
you know what? And you know what's funny about that era, Dave? The underneath guys, like in New York, a lot of them were real popular. Like, remember Special Delivery Jones?
Yeah.
Do you remember S.D. Jones?
Of course, S.D. Jones and Johnny Rods and those guys.
Right,
they were always there.
They were like cult favorites. They were just like, they had that kind of endearing quality.
Right, but they were. It's almost like in Florida, you know, they had this guy called Raul Mata, and you knew he was always
going to Raul Mata, I know, because he was super talented.
Yeah, and you know what's funny, bro? That was the first time that, like, it even occurred to me, like, okay, is something fixed or what's going on? And it was the Raul Mata, what I used to call the Raul Mata incident. Basically, if you remember the Spanish wrestling from L.A., what was that called?
Yeah.
SIN or what was it called?
Spanish International Network, which is now Univision.
Right. How awesome was that show? Do you remember that show?
Yeah, well, I grew up on that on Wednesday nights. I mean, you would get it on tape, but I would get it in here. We would get it live from, I believe it was 8 to 9:30 on Wednesday nights. So it was like a fixture to me. It was in Spanish. And it's like, you know, to this day, I watch it religiously, and I have no idea how I don't know Spanish, as much Spanish as I watched. I mean, I could like half-ass figure out a lot of it, you know, but
didn't they have
I should have learned the language as much as I saw.
Didn't they have like a lot of really cool angles? Remember?
Yeah, they had good angles. They had good talent. They had enough English to where, you know, you could get by. I mean, Gene LaBelle used to do English interviews, and Jeff Walton did English interviews, but it was the play-by-play was in Spanish with Luis Magana and Miguel Alonso.
Right, and the black lady that was sat in the first row. Remember her?
Oh, yeah. Always, yeah.
Did you ever hit her? Did you ever date that?
before my time.
Okay, well, like I wasn't 12. Sure. Well, you might have been into mature women at that time. Now, let me ask you a question. So let me tell you what happened. So I'm watching Florida wrestling, and if you remember, they took care of Raul Mata in L.A., right?
Yeah, well, he did real well in the early 70s and in San Francisco as well. Because
right.
the thing with the guys, if you were like in Mexico, if you were like a Mexican champion, like I think Raul Mata was Mexican light heavyweight champion and then NWA light heavyweight champion, and you came up to Los Angeles, they would push the hell out of you because
right.
of the Mexican
connection.
And it'd be less in San Francisco, but it would still, you know, there was always, you always had to have a Mexican on a show. In for Roy Shire, so he was only two or three Mexican guys there, and Raul Mata at one point was the, you know, I don't want to say the token guy, but he was the guy. And in L.A. they had a lot of guys, but he was always protected. But yeah, when he went to L.A. they didn't protect him at all, and it always was like when I would go to L.A. and I would see Raul Mata's jobber, I would think, God, I grew up with this guy, and he was over. It wasn't even like he wasn't, you know, he was some guy who they pushed that wasn't over. He was over. He had charisma, and he was a, you know, he was actually a hell of a worker.
Right. Well, I remember him being used right when I was watching him in L.A. Maybe I was just too young to really give a shit about wins or losses. I don't remember, but I do remember that I saw him as a star in L.A., okay? And
yeah.
when he came to Miami, they were jobbing him out, and I was like, fuck, what the hell happened when you got from California to Florida? Is the wrestling here that much better or what? You know, what's going on? That was like one of the first times that I really, you know, like one thing didn't make sense with the other. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean,
which you couldn't really get away with today.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I, you know, we did, because we would get the L.A. promotion on Wednesdays, and we would get the Roy Shires on Saturdays. And there were guys that would be stars in Los Angeles that would come up, and Roy Shires would use them as job guys. It really wasn't so much in the other direction like that. I think because Roy Shires like was real demanding that if you use my guys, they have to work on top. Because I remember like Jeff Walton telling me about how they were always mad because Roy would abuse their guys. And Roy's thing was as well, our TV doesn't go into your territory. You know what I mean? Like the San Francisco TV wasn't aired. It didn't air in San Diego. It didn't air in Los Angeles. I think that Fresno Bakersfield was kind of a crossover, but they were, you know, but like Roy's thing was, is that your TV airs in our area, so you can't beat my guys. And, you know, but they would always go, like, you know, we send like our, you know, they would send like, you know, Gordman and Goliath or people like that, that were kind
those
of pushed.
Those guys were awesome.
And Roy would do, you know, I mean, Roy wouldn't go and do anything with them. You know, he eventually when the talent started running dry, you know, he started using the LA guys better. But when, in the early 70s, I mean, I remember I would go to L.A. because we had relatives there, and I would see all these guys, and then they would come up in our territory and just be used as job guys. And it's like, God, these guys are talented. But, you know, Roy was really into guys who could really work his style, and also, you know, more than the promo guys in L.A. because they had so much more TV and did more promos. You know, a guy like John Toll is just an example, who wasn't really a great worker but was an excellent promo guy. You know, he was a king in Los Angeles, but when Roy would use him, he was like a, you know, a guy in his 40s that was a so-so worker, and we were used to great workers, so Roy wouldn't really push him that hard.
Right, which is, you know, it's just funny how times have changed, and you could do that back then. You really couldn't do it today. That, you know what I'm saying? You could,
yeah, well,
but
I mean,
it isn't, guys are, you know, protected because everybody knows who they are now, where before you only knew them like regionally.
Yeah. And also now, I mean, when you're with a company, you're, and I don't want to say you're with them for life, but you're with them for years. So
right.
there isn't this thing of, you know, you when guys were switching, you know, like with San Francisco and Los Angeles, not only would guys switch companies every 6 months or so, or 9 months or whatever it was, but the other aspect is like, because of the geographical nature, I mean, you would have guys that were on Los Angeles TV and, you know, Roy did his TV on Monday nights or sometimes on Thursday nights. And he would just, you know, get job guys or guys from Los Angeles, they would just come up, you know. So it was like they would be working both territories at the same time. And we even had situations where we had, you know, Los Angeles ran on Friday and San Francisco ran on Saturday. And you would have, if it was a big name like the Funks or Ernie Ladd or somebody like that, they would work, you know, main events, you know, come in for the two main events. So they were in two separate circuits, and sometimes even like as a babyface in one and a heel in the other, depending on what the promoters wanted.
Now let me ask you a question. Out of, you know, so many years that you've been watching wrestling and reading about it and watching tapes, who would you say that are like the top three bookers that you've ever seen? You know,
that's really hard, because you know what? So much of it is time and place. Because I mean, the perfect example is like Bill Watts. I mean, you know, Bill Watts in the 80s with Mid-South Wrestling, and granted, he used a booker, but he was really the final authority guy. And I remember those TVs, and those were some of the best TVs I ever saw. But in 1990, you know, whatever it was, 92, 93, when he came to WCW, you know, he had been out of the game for 5 years, and things had changed, the talent had changed, and he wasn't that good. But, you know, so it's
okay, so obviously Bill Watts 91 sucked, and Bill Watts 85 was awesome, right?
Bill Watts in the 80s was tremendous. Jerry Jarrett was tremendous when he was, you know, in his ilk in the Memphis area, without a doubt. A lot of people knocked Ken Mantell, and it really was only about 2 years, but he really was great for the 2 years, even though Gary Hart set him up, and you know, in the sense that he gave him all the pieces, but he did run well with the pieces for about a year or two, even though, like, you know, you know, Gary was great, you know. Eddie Graham had the rep. Roy Shires had the rep. Vince McMahon, to me, you know, if you look at Vince McMahon in the 80s, I think that Vince was absolute. I don't know if, you know, if the word genius is the right word, but he had a vision of what he was doing, and he really could see what he was doing, and he did it. So he was great. I mean, he was, you know, in many ways, I'll look at that and go, you know, that may have been some of the best of all time, because he knew, this is when he like knew a year ahead where he was, you know, he was so far ahead of where he was going. You know, when you do the week to week, then, you know, it's, I don't think the booking's nearly as good when you're changing things every week, because your stories just get all screwed up. You know, Court, you know this, you may have come up with, you know, we all know, you know, we've all heard the stories. You come up, you get this great 12-week story,
right,
and it probably is a great 12-week story, and then in week two, it's changed in this direction, so that weeks 3 through 10 don't matter anymore, and then in the end, you go like, God, it never clicked.
Right. Well, I mean, today it's right. Everyone says, "Well, I'm a writer," and you think you're a booker. Bookers are so different than writers. Writers' jobs are so radically different. They're not finished men. They're not talent selectors. They typically 99% of the time don't do match selection in terms of, okay, this is a good opening match. That's a good, you know, match in the middle. That's a match we want to bring them back up with. They don't do that. They write, they produce, they cast. They're suggesters for some matches and stuff like that, but they're not bookers. Bookers, they don't really, in the traditional sense, exist, really. And I think you see the kind of the results of that now. I mean, it's a totally different game. I always thought that Vince, just being around him and stuff, I always felt that he was the best promoter ever. Like, just ever.
Oh, fantastic promoter. Yeah. Without a doubt, the best promoter ever. Yeah.
But I didn't feel he was a great booker. I think he was always surrounding himself with a Pat Patterson or, you know, in his day, in the moment, a, you know, whether it was Paul Heyman SmackDown, say 02 to 04, or a Vince Russo, you know, 97 to 98, or whatever that was. He was good with, he could navigate what the writers and the bookers were doing and do the most as a promoter. I never felt that he was, like, at least when my time around him, which, you know, isn't during his peak years.
You know, I think one of the things with the bookers, I think that there's an age thing. In the sense of, when you get too old, I think that you're probably not a great booker, even if you were. I don't know exactly what, you know, and I think that changes, it varies with people. I remember Barnett, and then granted, Barnett was not a booker at all.
Right.
But I remember Barnett, like, kind of, like, you know, talked to me about that once when we were talking about, like, I don't remember what it was. It was, like years later. And you know, Barnett had that great success in Australia for years, then he left.
Right.
And then things happened. And I guess this is, like, 82, 83. And, you know, he got kicked out of Georgia by Ole Anderson.
Yeah.
Okay. And I said, you know, why don't you go back to Australia? Australia had been, you know, taken down. It was back to being, you know, I don't want to say virgin territory, but there was nothing happening so much in Australia at the time. And, you knew everyone, you knew the landscape. It was, you know, you were gone for 9 years. Things had changed, but, you know, you popped it the first time, and he just goes, you just you have to understand your limitations. And he goes, you get one of those runs in your lifetime.
Yeah.
You don't, you know, most people aren't going to get two. Now Vince did. Vince got a couple because he, I think the first one was brilliance. The second one, I think that pieces fell, you know, together. There's a lot of different pieces that fell together. Number one was Bischoff of all people, elevating the profile of wrestling with Nitro and changing the game, which forced Vince to adapt. And then the other one was, you know, he became a character, of course, but he lucked into Austin and The Rock at the same time, and nobody's ever had, like, people have had one of those, you know, like with a Hulk Hogan or Bruno Sammartino or you know, whatever, Dusty to an extent.
Right.
But nobody's ever had both at the same time. And I think that you know, that was really, that was just, you know, and they had a great supporting cast as well.
Yeah.
You know, but those two guys at the same time was just an overwhelming, you know, they couldn't be held back unless you really were screwed up. Now, WCW, I believe, would have screwed both of those two guys up, though.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, too, because you look at the culture, and I was talking to JR about this, is that when you look at the culture, say, 95 of that locker room, 96, the talent selection, and how it started to radically shift the work ethic and the talent that was being selected from, like, 96, 97 to, say, 2002, all the talent they recruited and all of the success they've had with that talent, from Brock Lesnar to Rock and all points in between, Randy Orton, John Cena, Rey Mysterio, the guys they brought in through their system. I mean, I can't remember. It's really unprecedented that you'd see so many great pieces of talent all come through one system. I mean, it was amazing to me.
Yeah, but if you really look at it, there's not a doubt in my mind that there was never a company that had more talent than the late 90s WCW. If you really look at that thing, but they squandered. I mean, like, there's guys there, you know, and I'm just throwing out a name that Conan's going to know super well, okay, and you're going to know, and a lot of people aren't going to know, and they're going to go, you know, what the fuck are you talking about, right?
Right.
But I'll just give an example. Silver King. I mean, I'm not talking about Silver King today in 2014, but Silver King in 1997, I mean, that guy was absolutely great. Hector Garza, you know, a guy like that, you know, Chris Jericho. I mean, all of these guys, Eddie Guerrero, you know, Eddie
yeah.
Guerrero was ready to go. Chris Benoit was ready to go. And, you know, that's why I said, like, if Austin had never gone, I don't care what character he came up with, he'd have hit his head on that same, you know, brick wall that everybody else did. He'd have never gotten past a certain level. And Rock, you know, I think Rock would have just been beaten right out of the system. You know, is just, you know, his first failure and then just forgotten about. And if some people in that era, if some really sharp guys figure out, hey, you know, this guy's good looking and he's tall and he's really good athlete, they may have even worked harder to make sure he didn't get over. You know, Conan, you were there. You know what the mentality was. I mean, we could look at, like, again, we talk about these guys that were really big in WWE, Austin, Foley, Rey Mysterio, Eddie Guerrero, you know, Jericho. Those guys, they were all in WCW when they were younger and every bit as good. I mean, Eddie improved in other ways, but they were all great at the time and could have been pushed. And, you know, WCW was not given opportunities, but they had, you know, they had 200 guys and so much talent.
Yeah, it was tough, Dave. You know, I mean, and the guys on top, they were afraid for their life. They were like, holy shit, there's no way we can emulate this fucking style that, you know, Dean and Eddie and the Mexican, you know, are doing. So fuck it, we're just going to squash them. And every time they had, and even though they hated each other, they had one thing in common. They were not going to let us pass by. And even me, that at one time, you know, I was very popular there and I was with the NWO and I kind of sneaked my head in there. The minute I got over, I was crushed. And it was just hard. Nobody was going to get by. You know, they were all in unison. That's why you never saw anybody get by. The only guy that got by was Goldberg. And he was a part of our group. And he was a
Page
freak
too.
King, kind of. And Page. Well, Goldberg
was over before they figured out to stop him.
Right.
And
right.
And Page, I think Page was the one guy who they let in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In a sense that, look, Randy Savage put Page over. And I mean, like,
yeah.
That, you know, and that really is what, you know, in those days,
so did Hall and Nash when he refused to join the NWO and he diamond cut them. Remember that? That
right.
Got
and that's,
him over like
that's
a
how you get guys. That's how you get guys over when you know, you have 10 guys running in, getting beaten up by two, you know, the 10 guys aren't going to get over so well.
Right. Let me ask you a question. Did you see The Divas on the Arsenio Hall show, either one of you.
I didn't see that one, no.
That was a great transition, by the way.
Did you, Kurt?
No, I didn't even know they were on it.
All right, well, I did. And they were all there. Now they had Summer Rae is in the cast, as you know, because you watched the Divas too, right, Dave?
Yeah, and I'm pretty familiar with, you know, stuff they've been filming and stuff for the next season and everything too. Yeah,
is JoJo right. still with the company? I can't get.
She's still with the company, but I don't know that we'll ever see her again.
I mean, they put her on that show way too early. I mean, she was way in over her head. I mean, it's like I feel bad. I mean, it's one thing to have an outsider coming, but she was just so young. She had to be like 20, 19.
She was 19 when they put her on there, and I think that they just wanted, you know, the dynamic that was going to be introducing two new people, and they wanted those two new girls to be like roommates and best friends.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you could tell towards the end of the season that she got less and less visible, which is funny because
they were like jobbing her out on her own show.
Yeah, I think that there were things that she did that weren't on the air that probably didn't help her any as far as like behavior thing goes.
Yeah.
And then the other one too is what was weird though is like when they would do those matches, those 14 women matches with the Divas against the non-Divas or whatever, it's like every time JoJo tagged in, like the people did like her. They always popped for her, and they always hated, you know, Eva Marie, because Eva Marie kind of came off as like this pretty girl that,
Even though she had a JoJo name and hair, she was like charismatic, and there's something, you know, there was something there, you know what I'm saying? And
yeah, people did like her, but you know, she was in, like, again, they pushed her really hard. I think the difference with Eva Marie is I think that they felt that Eva Marie, you know, was someone that they could market and get into Maxim and, you know, things like that, and she was really hot, and so that would overcome the fact that she was absolutely horrible in the ring. And you know, I think the powers that be liked Eva Marie, even though I think most people who dealt with her, I heard more negative than positive, way more negative than positive on her as a person, but even the ones who hated her go, well, she is really good looking.
Yeah, no, she's definitely hot, she just sucks in the ring. And at the end of the day, people can tell, they're not like, oh wow, she's so good looking, I'm going to let her fly that she can't wrestle. It's like, no, bitch, there has been a standard set in WWE by girls like Trish Stratus, want you to look good, and we also want you to wrestle. It's not like either or, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, when she tagged in, of course, I think a lot of it was the portrayal of her on that TV show, but every time she would tag in, the people would always boo and everything, you know, whether she was, even when she was a babyface.
I would like to say, Dave, that these girls came out on the Arsenio Hall show, and they tried to like start beef between Summer Rae and Natalie.
Oh yeah, because they're gonna feud them on the show.
Okay, and it came off so forced, so contrived, so JoJo, and there is no other fucking word. And I was just like, fuck, man, we're supposed to be better than this, you know? It just still looked so like fake, you know what I'm saying? And then the other thing is, they had these girls do like a talent contest. You're going to love one of the girls' talents, but first let me tell you the other one. one of the Bella twins, I'm not sure which one. I think the one that's with Daniel Bryan, because she kept trying to get the yes chant going and nobody went with it. She actually played a harmonica. Blew a harmonica, whatever. I got something she can blow. And then they had another one with the Funkadactyl one, not the one that got the eye crush. How awesome!
Oh, well, Cameron, Ariana, right. Andrews.
How awesome if they want to get rid of Divas and they don't know how to let them go and they just have Oksana drop the knee on them. That's like your way of knowing. Well, I guess they don't want me anymore. So they had the one girl that doesn't have the fucking fucked up eye doing a. What do you think she did?
I have no idea what she did.
Singing.
What
do you think? Some sort of singing, right?
No, she didn't sing, even though I saw somewhere she's coming out like with an album. It's like, I don't understand. So all of a sudden you're on TV and you just learned how to sing. And so so anyways, she went up there and she danced, Dave. It's like, wow, that's a stretch from what you do on TV. And the dance wasn't even that good. Then they had, I forgot what the other bitches did, but I do remember this, that one of the Bellas, I think is the one that's with Cena, she was the most talented one. Huh?
Is she out there trying to sell real estate?
No. No. this is what her talent was. She gave a hug. Aww. How brutal was that? She had no talent. She just said, "Oh, I give good hugs," and then she won. And I was like, fucking show didn't. This show did nothing to push them. Did nothing to make me interested in their division. I thought it was kind of like a waste of time, and I thought you guys would too if you would have seen it, but you didn't.
I heard that Arianne, when they told her about this show, had no idea who Arsenio Hall was, and I wasn't sure if that was like a problem with her or. Or, you know, because Arsenio is from a different generation.
It's true.
You know what I mean? Really, when he was popular, it was like the 90s. But I thought, wow, things changed so much that no one knows him anymore.
Yeah, but he's back on the air now. And if
I know he's on the air. I saw a show when Dana was on, and I saw him. I think he had Austin on, too, that I saw.
Yeah, yeah.
I know you know that. And so he's back on the air now, and he's the only black host on TV. You wouldn't just watch it out of curiosity because they always have a lot of black stars you don't see in other places. And every fucking star that goes on there, everyone that's like really big now, they all put them over. They go, wow, I finally made it. I finally made it to the Arsenio Hall show because when I was a nobody, you were a somebody. When I was first in the game, I always wanted to be on your show. And they always put them over. So it's pretty hard for me to believe that if you're an African American in the entertainment industry, you don't know who the fuck Arsenio Hall is.
No, I actually know someone that was on the show, and he's like 21, and so it was a big deal for him. So I think it's just she's just in her own world.
So it's her.
I think it's she's just in her own world. And the reality is, listen, the diva thing sounded pretty brutal on the Arsenio Hall show, but I think there's been worse wrestling appearances on the Arsenio Hall show.
Oh, if you look
back to Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan is the one.
Hulk Hogan nearly ruined his career on that show.
That was the one. It's the
I remember that night because it was like that was a big deal. It was summer of 91.
Right.
And I'm watching, and we were watching it on tape delay because it was, you know, I was watching on the West Coast, and I had people calling me up going, you just got to watch. And I'm watching this going like, God, you ruined your whole career. Now, he didn't end up ruining his career, but he did a number on it. And you know, I mean, I think Vince, my opinion is that whole thing of what happened in like 92, 93, that whole, you know, decline of Vince McMahon's company. I think that I can trace it to that Arsenio Hall appearance by Hulk Hogan. If Hulk Hogan had just been honest, I think that everything, a lot of that scandal stuff would have gone away. But by lying, then it was like everybody started going like, God, he's so, you know, come on. Like, you know, it insulted people's intelligence.
Now, my introduction to Dave Meltzer was through the Donahue show, which was around that time.
A couple months later.
Yeah. Now, so that happened first. Then the Donahue thing comes together. You get called to come out and do that. And that had to be a really interesting time. That was a very awkward show with that panel. And I don't know how much of our listeners even know about the Donahue incident and the show and everything, but that was, to me, some of the most tense TV I had seen at that point in my life. That, I mean, just watching.
That was.
I mean, it was crazy.
That was an amazing day because there's so much behind the scenes of what happened. You know, it involved Vince Russo was there, although he was not on the show, but he was around. And, you know, that's actually the first time I ever met Vince Russo. And, you know, you had all these cast of characters, you know, all of whom I knew. And everyone on every side, it was just kind of like, you know, it was weird because nobody knew that Vince was going to do the show. Vince was invited on the show.
Right.
But it was the word that we were getting is Vince isn't going to do it. And I was kind of worried because the other guys were just so gung-ho, and they were just going to go, you know, it's like they would tell the truth, but then they would go so far because there's no filter, and then you had Superstar, you know, who was in his mind, I think Superstar was there with the idea that I'm going to get myself back over on New York television, you know, like an old worker would do, you know, I'm going to go in there, I'm going to go on. Phil, you know, because remember, Phil Donahue was a giant show in 1991.
Yeah,
it was 92. It was before his fall. He was, you know, every, you know,
very
it
relevant.
Was a big deal.
Yeah,
right. The show aired live, and I remember like I was with Superstar, and like afterwards, you know, we're walking down New York right after the show's over, and he's getting, oh, we saw you on Donahue, Superstar, and I mean, you could just see this guy beaming because it was like, where I was in 77, 78, right? And then
right.
It's like, we're going to go, I'm going to get a book deal. I'm going to be all over the media. So everyone had their, but so anyway, so Vince shows up and it's the funniest thing because there's Barry Orton, who was Randy's uncle.
Yes.
Barry Orton's there and he's friends with this kid named Tom Cole, who I ended up, you know, knowing, and he's still around and stuff. But anyway, Tom Cole was the guy who probably precipitated all this in the sense of he was the guy who went to Phil Mushnick and said, you know, like that the ring boys were being abused by Terry Garvin and Mel Phillips. And, you know, he was fired in his mind. And, I think the what happened was is he wouldn't fool around with Mel Phillips. And at least that's his story. And then he told Phil Mushnick. Phil Mushnick was completely appalled and just thought, you know, how could this happen? So he wouldn't fool around with Mel Phillips, and then he gets fired, like, the next day from
right.
the ring crew.
Right.
So a couple months later, and he doesn't tell anyone. He's all ashamed. So he finally tells his brother, okay, you know, like, this is what happened. So his brother actually called Phil Mushnick. So anyway, so in how all this goes down, his first name actually is Randy, but he went by the name Barry. Barry Orton and Tom Cole had become friends. And then all of a sudden, like, Barry Orton goes, this was to me before the show, and just goes, he's not returning my calls. I think something's up. And he said it to me. And he just goes, I think that it would be, I just had this, he had this premonition, because don't bring up the name Tom Cole. Mm. Just don't do it. And he just told me that. And I think he told a couple of other guys that as well. And it was this weird thing. It's like, okay, whatever, you know, whatever. I wasn't there. They weren't bringing me there, and they talked about Tom Cole anyway, so it wasn't a big deal to me. As it turns out, Vince and Tom Cole had made a settlement. Tom Cole's in the audience sitting with Linda McMahon and Elizabeth. And the minute any of us was going to mention the name Tom Cole, you know, like, oh, what happened to Tom Cole?
Right.
They were going to spring him out like a Perry Mason final scene. They had it all set up. And believe me, if Orton hadn't said that, guaranteed, whether it was Graham, it probably wouldn't have been me, but it would have been him, or somebody would have brought up that name Tom Cole, and then we would have had this incredible scene that was set up, but it just didn't happen. And the funny part is, so the show is over, and I think that's the reason Vince went on the show, was that we were, you know, all these guys were going to hammer him and hammer him and hammer him, and he was going to look like crap, and then all of a sudden someone was going to slip up, mention that name. Well, here's Tom Cole in the audience, and he's going to go, you guys are all liars, and I love Vince McMahon, or, you know, however it's going to go, right?
Right.
However the setup spot's going to be. And then the show ends, and it didn't happen. And so Vince was really – I was sitting with Vince, and I was the closest thing to a friend he had, because I was in the middle. I wasn't on either side. I was and I'm talking to him, you know, during every commercial break, and when it's over, he's just wanting to get out of there. It was a bad day for him.
It was very, it was very bad. He looked terrible in that thing. I mean, he's a guy, like, I was there when the Benoit thing happened. And it's like, he's such a control freak. He didn't want an outside, he didn't want anyone from the outside handling damage control. He didn't want any firm or anyone. He wanted to do it all himself. He thought he could do it all himself. And I'm imagining how he manufactured this in his mind. He could come on that show and control this and get what he wanted.
It was going to be awesome from his standpoint.
Right.
I didn't know this. And then, like, after, like, literally 5-10 minutes after the show's over, one of the producers comes up to me, and Tom Cole's in the audience, and he goes to the producer, I'm Tom Cole, and these guys up there were all liars. And it's just like, wow, Tom Cole was in the audience. Randy, Barry Orton, he figured it out. And it's like, wow, that's why Vince came on the show.
That's awesome, and I would also be remiss if I didn't tell you a nice reference on the Perry Mason line. Boom. That qualifies as a verbal gem on this show.
Well, I got to tell you this one story, because this reminds me of something. I think I may have told you this, Carlos, you know, years and years and years ago, but it's my favorite Vince McMahon story, because that has to do something when you talk about a control freak, okay? This is from that same year. This is 1991. And, you know, they're getting all the heat on the steroids and everything. And, of course, at the same time, Vince is doing World Bodybuilding Federation. And, you know, so you know what that's all about.
Right.
And so I had a conversation with Vince, and I go, God, Vince, you know, you know, you get this, these guys, I mean, it's one thing with the wrestlers, but these guys, you know, that you got in the WBF, I mean, come on, right? You know, I mean, professional bodybuilders, you know what I mean? And you're, you know, it's a bad time to be in the bodybuilding business, you know? And he's, you know, I'm going to promote drug-free bodybuilding and all that. And then he goes, like, he tells me about, we had a meeting with the guys, and he's telling me, like, what happened in the meeting with the guys. And, you know, it's like I told them, you know, that, you know, you're not going to be the biggest guys in the gym anymore, but we're going to promote, I'm going to put you on TV, and I'm going to make you stars, and we're going to be drug-free, we're going to change the sport of bodybuilding, drug-free bodybuilding, and we're going to make it a health thing. And, you know, he had the whole thing. This is what he says happens in this thing. And he tells me about how the conversation goes down and the questions people have and this and this and this, right? So this is like, I'm guessing, I would say July, maybe August, maybe even September of 91, okay? Now, the story he told me, he never had that meeting with those guys. He just told me that story, okay? Because, you know, when I asked, right? Okay, but February 1992, this is months later, Vince has this meeting with those guys. And I heard about it from, you know, a friend of one of the guys is telling me about this meeting. And it's just like, word for word, what Vince told me about this meeting that hadn't happened was exactly what happened in that meeting. And what he did was, and it actually even came out years later, there was a guy, Gary Stridham was his big star. You know, he was the guy
who won all the contests. Yeah, I remember Gary Stridham.
You remember Gary Stridham? Yeah. He went to Gary Stridham, and he said, okay, Gary, you know, I'm going to say this, and you're going to say, I mean, there was a meeting, and all these bodybuilders, with the exception of Gary Stridham, were all thinking they were at this, you know, we're going to have this discussion in this meeting. And Vince and Gary Stridham basically controlled the whole meeting, scripted the meeting, and everything went exactly like Vince wanted, with the exception of Lou Ferrigno quitting, which he definitely didn't want to happen. But it was just like when I found out, like about, you know, a couple days, maybe a week or so after it happened, and I'm hearing from this bodybuilding guy, and he's telling me, like, this is what happened in the meeting. I go, holy crap. I go, like, this whole thing was, like, scripted out. And then years later, Gary Stridham actually came out and admitted, you know, which I knew, which, I mean, it was year, you know, but that's Vince. It's like, you know, you think it's a meeting, mm-hmm. like if you have a meeting with talent, but there's probably one guy in on it and they're controlling that meeting.
Right. Now that WBF thing, for those that don't remember, was a bodybuilding federation that Vince had started. And I don't know if they ever got on TV. I think they had a couple shows, right, on TV.
They were on TV. They were on TV on, I think, was it USA Corps?
Yeah, USA. It was like
WBF Body Stars. It was on like either Saturday or Sunday morning, because I used to watch it.
Yeah, I think Ultimate was replaced by like WWF Mania or something. But yeah, it was like 92, 93, and Lex Luger was even a part of the WBF.
Lex Luger was like the big star of the show because none of the bodybuilders had enough charisma to carry the show, but Vince and Lex and Cameo Newer were like, who was the younger sister of Corey Everson.
Right.
Because their feeling was that they wanted the next Corey Everson. They didn't want Corey Everson, who was like really the famous one. So they went with a newer, younger model. And they were like the big three stars, and they would do, vignettes with these guys training.
But I remember that at that time, he had just about every big bodybuilding name in the game, right?
It was most of a lot of the guys. He had a lot of guys. A lot of the guys were afraid to leave Joe Weider.
Right.
You know, I mean, he did have some
big names, right?
Gary Stridham was a big name. He couldn't get Lee Haney. He didn't get Lee Labrada. I think I don't remember all the guys' names, but there was Barry DeMay. I think was a big star. That was one of Vince's favorites. I remember that.
Now, because I don't remember that whole thing too well, but tell me if I'm correct on this. He did make everybody kind of completely or get off steroids. Everybody looked really smaller. The bodybuilders were complaining, and I think the consumers were complaining. Am I correct or no?
Okay, so what happened is the February meeting that I talked about, it was early 92, I'm thinking. So the first contest was just a normal contest, and it was just held in an auditorium, and Gary Stridham won. Then the second contest, which was the last one, that one was a live pay-per-view that completely bombed. It was one of the worst bought pay-per-views, like 5,000 buys or 6,000 buys in the whole country. Some incredible number that, and this is when being promoted like crazy on WWF television with, I remember like watching Kurt Hennig and Hawk, and they're like doing these things. Oh, this guy's going to win. Oh, this guy's going to win. Like they were promoting it, you know, like, you know what I mean? They were, you know, so, But people didn't buy it, and they had, I remember Bobby Heenan did the announcing on the pay-per-view with Vince, which was, you know, imagine Bobby Heenan, who knows nothing about bodybuilding, trying to do play-by-play of a bodybuilding show.
Now, let me ask you one quick question. You're a big bodybuilding fan, so you're watching this, and what are you thinking? This sucks, or it's too big? What were you thinking?
I didn't really think. I was just intrigued. It wasn't like I thought it was good or bad. But so anyway, like what you said was, so in that February meeting when Vince told everyone to get off, you know, in the second contest, it looked like everyone but two of the guys looked the same, and the other guys all looked like so far off, like you wouldn't even believe. And one guy named Mike Quinn.
Yeah, I remember Mike Quinn.
He looked horrible. Yeah. I mean, you know, and the rest of the guys just looked small. And right. You know, they looked like guys that you would see at the beach that had good physiques, but they didn't look like guys that you would.
So he did make everybody get up to juice.
Or it looked like, except for Gary Stridham and Jim Quinn, looked awfully big, but most of the guys looked like they were clean. But if you remember at that point, there was a year where they had the Mr. Olympia where they drug tested everyone too. So it was kind of like there was this thing, and in both cases, like the hardcore bodybuilding fans just hated it. They hated the Olympia that year, and they hated the WBF show that year. And so, you know, they just quietly dropped the drug testing of the guys because the hardcore fans wouldn't allow it, and they didn't have anything but hardcore fans. They had no mainstream. So, right. And Vince was the chance at mainstream, and it failed.
Now, I was talking with Kurt about this. I hadn't read it, but Kurt, tell me the thing that you were reading about CM Punk.
Oh, it's just we were talking about how the whole deal with CM Punk coming back to Chicago and how that story and how you just got attacked over the story, which, you know, is one of those interesting things because, you know,
it's interesting about, you know, the thing with Twitter, you know, and you know, I'm on Twitter all freaking day, which is like a complete lifestyle change for me. I mean, I'm not on it like all day, but I mean, I go through, you know, three, four times a day, I go through and spend time on it. But the thing with that 140 characters and spreading stuff, it's almost like things spread so quick because there's not enough characters to actually explain, things get twisted in a sense. I mean, it's like, you know, I said like one, you know, it was Saturday before the show. I think I did a show with Brian and I just go, somebody in the business, you know, who's a big name in the business told me, you know, 100% Punk's going to be there. And, you know, it's like, do you think he's going to be there? And I go, yeah, I mean, the guy's probably telling me the truth. You know what I mean? It's like someone who I've known for a long time. So I go, yeah, he probably will, but I'm not saying he will because I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's going on in this one. I mean, I just said that. I was on live audio wrestling. I pretty much said the same thing. But in Twitter, it was like, Dave Meltzer says 100% Punk's going to be there.
Right.
And then, of course, he wasn't. And then it's just like, oh, yeah, I had a day where people were at my throat. And to a degree, maybe they should have too. But I mean, when I was on the show, I mean, I explained what it was. I explained myself pretty clear, but you know, what I say, and I mean, the same thing happened to me actually in the MMA world that same week. It actually got me madder because with the wrestling, I kind of joke it off, but with MMA, it's kind of like, I was doing a show with Brian and I just said like, if I was Dana, you know, and Dana and I, when it comes to matchmaking, we actually think a lot alike, which he won't admit, but it's the truth. But anyway, I was going like, you know, look, we have this July show, and what are you going to do? And I was thinking, you know, I would call Gina Carano. You know, that's what I would do.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, he even did it, you know, just coincidentally. But I would call Gina Carano and put Ronda Rousey against Gina Carano. That's what I would do. And then it became a story that Dave Meltzer said that the July show is going to be Ronda Rousey. I mean, I hadn't talked to Dana White. It was just something that I thought I would do. And so everyone's going, Dave Meltzer said this, this, and this. And I even had people that at my own, you know, website, we're just going like, so what do you know about this? And I go, I know nothing. And it turned out there was something to it, but it's like, I know nothing. I'm just saying, if I was promoting, I would call her up and like, you know, just discuss with her, go, what's it going to take? And have the discussion. I'm not even saying I would, you know, I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if she has any interest at all, but I would make the call. I would go like, look, you know, we got a July show. We got a match. You can make a lot of money. If you want to fight, you want to train, you want it, and you can make weight. You know, we got a big marquee match for you because we got an opponent that you'll draw with. And, you know, I would see, what, you know, if she's enthusiastic about it because Ronda needed a big name opponent, and it was too early for Cyborg in my mind, and Gina and her, I think, would be a natural matchup. So, but, you know, it's like that thing. It's like Dave said that they're going to be this match on July 5th. It's like, I never said that.
Is Gina, do you think she would do a match at this time or a fight?
I don't know. I know it's been talked about. I mean, maybe it's a money thing. Maybe she, you know, yeah. I don't know what kind of money she's making in the movies right now. I don't know what kind of work she's getting. You know, she's around. I mean, it's not like she's not getting any work, but it's not like she's this hot in demand actress either.
Right.
So I don't know where she stands. I don't see her in a lot of TV commercials or things like that, which I did, you know, I saw her in some stuff before. So I don't know how, you know, I don't know what her standing, I don't really know what her standing is. Someone told me that Ronda's getting a lot of the work that she would have gotten.
That's,
you know, that Ronda's now the new It thing. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think it actually would help her career a lot, because that kind of was her calling card, was being a cage fighter. You know, the cute cage fighter thing was what she was kind of tagged as. And Ronda, yeah, she's taken that because she's got the UFC machine behind her and the hype. And actually, one of the things I was just showing Carlos was the four horsewomen thing that Ronda's doing. And Carlos didn't know who the other women in the picture were. And I guess now they just put out something on Instagram like this past week doing the wrestling moves. Did you see that?
Shayna Baszler is the one who's behind it. And Shayna Baszler is a huge pro wrestling fan. I mean, like, you know, like just major hardcore, trained with Billy Robinson, loves history of pro wrestling. You know what I mean? It's someone
right.
who like it's someone, you know, that you could get on the show and she would be an awesome guest. I mean, just awesome. And she got the other three. It was Jessamyn Duke, who was on Ultimate Fighter, the tall girl who was on Ronda's team. Ronda. And then the fourth is Marina Shafir, who was a judo woman who's now doing MMA that Ronda knew from judo and was Ronda's been best friends with probably for years and years. So they're like the four horsewomen, and they do the four fingers. And I guess at the a couple weeks ago in Ontario, when they had the SmackDown tapings in Ontario, a couple of them, Ronda was not there, but a couple of the other ones were there. And Daniel Bryan, like when he's out there, when the cameras were off, like he points to them and does the four fingers. And they did the four fingers back, and they just were, you know, they were just like, so, oh, Daniel Bryan, the biggest star in the whole business, and gave us the four fingers and everything. They were just thrilled.
Well, someone's got to tell them to make a T-shirt, because they can make a few bucks off of that. And I guess
I'm sure people are talking to them because they're trying to market that four horsemen.
Oh my God! Yes.
It was originally the deal was going to be Armbar Nation, but I think that the four horsewoman is
much better.
I think that it's got a good ring to it.
I guess Duke would be the Sid Vicious of the group then.
Barry Windham.
Barry Windham is a more complimentary one.
Who's the one that looks like ODB but more manly?
That's Shayna. Shayna's the one who looks like ODB. Shayna Baszler is the one who looks like. Yeah, she's the one who looks like ODB. Yeah.
You want to be flattering? We might want to have her on as a guest. Come on now. Now
she'd be a great guest though if you want to talk about old, you know, wrestling and Billy Robinson and.
Oh, did she train with Billy at all?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Wow.
That's why I talked to her last week about because when Billy passed away, because I knew her and Josh Barnett were of the, you know, I mean, obviously Harry Smith trained with him,
right?
You know,
probably
as much as anyone, but Harry was in England but of the ones that were around, you know, I can't talk to Sakuraba; he barely knows English. So those were the two that I spoke with were her and Josh Barnett, and you know, she went to his seminars and he, like, if you were a student of Billy, like the ones that he really liked and respected, like Harry Smith and Shayna and Barnett, I mean, he kept in contact with them. He would email them. I mean, I was surprised. I thought, well, you know, she went to some seminars with him and, you know, she was taught by him, but it's like, she would hear from him, you know, those people that he cared about, he was on them and, you know, like, you know, this and this and, you know, you know, always just, you know, trying to be enthusiastic and, you know, build them up and things like that.
Now, Jim Ross was in Las Vegas meeting with UFC officials. What do you think there? Do you think there's something there? Do you think I mean, there's got to be a reason for it.
Well, there's a reason, but I don't think he's going to announce for them. I don't think he thinks he's going to announce for them. You know, there's a part of me that really wants him to do it because there's certain innate things that Jim Ross, I mean, as an announcer, he's really, I always thought that Jim Ross could be the best UFC play-by-play guy, but I don't think he would be right away. I mean, like, because it's you got to develop your sea legs, and I'm just afraid. I was always, my thoughts on Jim Ross as an announcer, because people go, oh, he'll announce like wrestling. It's like, you know, he didn't announce football like wrestling. He won't announce MMA like wrestling, but he'll have the knowledge and the understanding of how to do programs, set things up, how to call what to call, how to protect the loser, or the guy who's getting his ass
right.
kicked. There have been certain fights that I've watched, and it's no offense to anyone like Goldberg, who's actually a friend of mine, but, I mean, where I said, like, you know, if Jim Ross was announcing this fight, it would be up a notch. Same way when if I watch WWE and it's Michael Cole and John Layfield and Waller, and I go, like, eh, it's too bad that Ross isn't announcing this one. You know, and I get
right.
that, you know, Corey, you and I have talked about this.
Right, right.
I get this when I watch New Japan Pro Wrestling, yeah. when they have one of those really awesome main events that's the real dramatic, long, brutal match, and just go, God, you know, it's fun to me listening in Japanese, but if Jim Ross, like, knew these guys and could tell the story of this match, man, you know what I mean? That'd be just so incredible.
Yeah.
But I think he could do the same thing with the UFC once he learned how to announce UFC, but I don't know that he'll ever get the chance.
Yeah, I think if you put him with, like, a Kenny Florian or someone that could handle the mechanics of what's going on in there to give that context, and he could give the story, and I think that'd be a great combination, because he could lean on someone that, you know, like a Joe Rogan, who can talk about the ground game, the jiu-jitsu, and look how he's trying to work that hold. And that would maybe complement him better than, you know, putting him with like a John Anik or something like that. But I think it'd be interesting to try him. I mean, just as in some, I mean, they have so much programming. I mean, it's like you put him on the fight pass. Okay, see how it goes. Or like when they did the dry run with the Brits. Just have them commentating and just kind of fine tune it until you're ready to go live, you know, ready for prime time, so to speak. Do a few test runs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, the stigma. There's two things. Number one is the age, and the other one is the pro wrestling stigma.
Right.
But the thing is I mean, like, on a personal level, as best I can tell from the people who I know in UFC, think very highly of him. I mean, it's not like anyone goes, the pro wrestling guy. And a lot of people in UFC, I mean, you know, it's like the people in that company, they're not negative on pro wrestling. They, you know, most of them, I don't say most of them, but many of the ones there grew up as pro wrestling fans, like, you know, a little bit after me, but like with your age, Court, you know, like, and maybe even some before. I mean, like, you know, Joe Silva's booking background was growing up watching George Scott in the Carolinas and, you know, not that that's like his pattern. He doesn't copy George Scott, but it's, you know, that's one of those things that you learn. It's like, okay, this is how this happens. And, you know, the whole, you know, the winners fight the winners and things like that. I mean, that's, you know, his, you know, how he grew up, you know, learning, you know, that in a sense was from the, you know, the Ric Flair pro wrestling in the late 70s living in Richmond, Virginia. And there's other people like that. And they have great respect for Jim Ross. And they, you know, and they think he's kind of like a celebrity to them and all that. But putting them on the air, it's like a hurdle, and I don't know that that's a hurdle they're going to get past. But I think there's that fear if we put them on and he's not good, and then they're going to go, oh, you're, you know, because the one thing that they are afraid of is they don't want to be people go, oh, you're just WWE, and they should be. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want people to go, you're not WWE. You know, obviously you can learn. I mean, like Lorenzo Fertitta, when it came to the business model. He'll tell you the first thing when they bought that company was he studied the WWE business. He didn't want to be WWE, but he sure wanted to copy the way they did their business.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, if you look at the UFC / Zuffa business model, you see a lot of the old school wrestling DNA threaded throughout how they do their fight builds and just how they present their fighters and everything. But anyway, speaking of business, we got to close the shop up for today, but Dave has graciously agreed to come back and do a special MLW Radio Extra podcast with us this Wednesday exclusively on MLW VIP. So if you're a VIP member, you'll get that podcast exclusively. Sign up at MLWVIP.com to become a member. That's MLWVIP.com. And you'll get that show. You'll get Corny's Drive-Thru with Jim Cornette, the Writer's Room with Greeny and ex-WWE writers, and so much more. It costs just $15 for a whole year of exclusive podcasts in our entire back archives. And follow Dave on Twitter at Dave Meltzer, WON. And make sure and don't give him too much shit about that CM Punk thing, man. And if you want to read what everyone from Vince McMahon and Dana White on down to JoJo read to stay informed on the wrestling and fight game, subscribe to his newsletter. Just go over to F4WOnline.com. wrestlingobserver.com or wrestlingobserver.com and sign up right now. Dave, thanks so much for coming on, and we'll see you and Conan back here on Wednesday. See you guys.
Daniel Bryan, the biggest star in the whole business, gave us the four fingers and everything. They were just thrilled.